Those of us who live in modern-day America sometimes reflect with something like nostalgia on America's glorious beginning. You know, the days when great men roamed the fresh new streets of our great cities, thought great thoughts, and printed them in great newspapers? Well, actually, not so great newspapers, as Eric Burns proves persuasively in his new book called Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. Burns is also the host of Fox News Channel's Fox News Watch, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
I feel welcome, Brooke. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about America's first great newspaper-generated scandal. It featured a celebrity who the newspaper charged with acting recklessly. I'm talking, of course, about Cotton Mather.
Cotton Mather, who was a celebrity because he was the primary religious figure, not only in Boston, but in Massachusetts and in the colonies at the time. He was the son of Increase Mather, who was also a famous cleric and had been at one point the president of Harvard. And he was also, Cotton, the author of more than 400 books. On the other side, there was James Franklin, who I think we could probably call America's first crusading journalist. He founded a paper called the New England Courant. The problem, Brooke, was that he wasn't very good at picking his crusades. His first one, for instance, was against inoculation for smallpox. And because the Mathers and other notable figures in Massachusetts believed in it at the time, and because Franklin just had some kind of built-in, almost prenatal, it seems, grudge against the establishment, he savaged the Mathers and everyone else who believed in inoculation. And then, when it was proven that inoculation was the cure for smallpox, he did something very modern as a journalist. He dropped the subject. No retraction, no apology. He went on to his next crusade.
And his next crusade eventually got him kicked off his paper.
Well, the next crusade was actually more political in nature. He just thought that the political officials who were running Massachusetts, and they were appointed by the crown, were not doing nearly enough, for instance, to prevent the ravages of pirates along the Massachusetts shore. He didn't like the way a lot of the internal workings of the government went. And he criticized the government so much that he finally had to flee the colony. Back then, by the way, Brooke, you had to get permission from the government to start a newspaper. And James Franklin was in trouble right from the start because he never got that permission initially.
And so when he fled the colony, he left his print shop in the hands of his young apprentice, 9 years younger than he was, his younger brother, Benjamin Franklin,
who he did not like at all. He probably beat Benjamin physically. We know that he would not let Ben write for the paper. As a matter of fact, Ben's first writings ever to appear in print were published under the name in the New England Courant of Silence Dugood, who purported to be a 60-year-old widow. Now, here's Ben, I don't know, 13, 14, 15 years old, male, writing letters as if he were a 60-year-old woman because he wanted to do anything he could to hide the real identity of the author from his brother. And he was right to do that. If his brother had known who Silence Dugood was, Ben would not have been published in the New England Courant.
Benjamin Franklin was quite fond of women's names as pseudonyms, wasn't he?
He was. He was not only Silence Dugood, but at another point he was Alice Addertongue. He was Celia Shortface. And in fact, everyone who wrote journalism in colonial times did so under another name.
You have a list of the names that Alexander Hamilton used.
Yes, he was Publius, he was Pacificus, he was Catullus, he was Americanus, he was Metellus, Horatius, just to name a few. Initially, people chose pseudonyms to hide their identity because it was just thought to be a little gauche to be expressing your opinions as crudely as so many of the founders did. To me, the most fascinating thing to consider about infamous scribblers is that the golden age of America's founding turned out to be the gutter age of American journalism. It took a long time for fairness to become an ideal in journalism. The greatest example of unfairness is Sam Adams. Now, as a brand of beer, Sam Adams, I guess, is one of the best.
As a brand of patriot, one of the best.
Yes, because his horrible means were devoted to one of history's great ends. But consider just as a journalist, Brooke, he wrote lies. He wrote about British soldiers in Boston sexually assaulting American women on the streets of Boston. This is before the war, because he wanted to bring war about. you would not know from his writing, but the Boston Tea Party was as much the Boston Gazette's as it was the city of Boston's. It was probably planned in the Boston Gazette offices. A lot of the, what should we call them, marauders, we shouldn't call them Indians, but the marauders who made themselves up to be Indians, they did that at the Boston Gazette. And some historians think that afterwards, after they had dumped, I think it was something like 340 barrels of tea into Boston Harbor. After that had been done, some of them went back to the Boston Gazette to have a little drink in celebration.
We've been talking so far about Patriot publishers, which were a scurrilous lot, I guess, in themselves oftentimes. But perhaps the most fascinating and certainly the most mysterious of the publishers that you cite isn't a patriot, but a determined Tory by the name of Jemmy Rivington, who spilled tons of ink excoriating George Washington.
It was very tough to be a printer in those days who sympathized with the crown because there was so much opposition. And people wondered how it was that he could get away with this. Now, he didn't get away with it as far as the populace was concerned. People hated his newspaper, but he was never arrested. No government officials ever came to visit him, except to browse occasionally through his bookstore in the back of his printing office. And the reason the government officials did that is that we later found out that Jemmy Rivington was a spy. And because he was so trusted by the crown, he would occasionally glean bits of military intelligence. He would write them down on sheets of paper, slip them into the pages of his books, and General Washington would occasionally send his men into Jemmy's bookstore to buy a book, and in that book would be information. We don't know the nature of it because it has not lasted the centuries, but it could have been information that saved American lives and perhaps sped up the course of the war.
How important do you think American newspapers were, in general, in determining the outcome of the war?
I think they were crucial. It is not just my view. It is the view of a lot of other historians. It is also the view of the British at the times. When the war ended, several British officers were known to say, if it had not been for your newspapers, for colonial newspapers, you would not have won the war. Newspapers were a source of unity to this nation before it was a nation, at a time when it needed unity as much as it needed ammunition.
And then after it was a nation, newspapers were a source, I think you could argue, of great disunity. In fact, later in Washington, after the Revolution, the argument began over what kind of a nation to create. Two newspapers lined up as proxies in the battle between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, which is to say the war between the Federalists who supported a strong central government and the Republicans who supported giving more power to the states.
It's a remarkable and little known story. Hamilton and Jefferson both served in Washington's cabinet, and it made sense for Hamilton to do so because he was a Federalist like Washington. It didn't make sense for Jefferson to do so because he was the leading figure of the opposition, but he was a very famous and estimable man, so Washington appointed him Secretary of State. Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury, and he appropriated Treasury Department funds to start a newspaper to promote Washington's point of view. One thinks today of George Bush paying money to Armstrong Williams to do something similar. But Hamilton defended this. He said, what better use for government money than to promote the government side of an issue, to let people know what the government thinks? All right, we'll give him a pass on that, sort of. But Jefferson appropriated, or misappropriated, I should say, State Department money to trash the very government in which he held one of the highest positions. And not only that, he helped to found the newspaper. He helped to choose the editor. And he would, Brooke, on occasion, leave the door of the State Department unlocked at night so that the editor, who was named Philip Freneau and was one of the most famous poets of the first century of American life, Freneau would come in at night, and Jefferson would leave drafts of documents on his desk that could be quoted out of context to make the administration look bad.
So the history of the leak, as old as the nation itself.
Older even than the example I just gave you. Most historians believe that George Washington invented the leak and did it the same way that it's done now. He would have some of his cabinet officers, some of his military officials take a journalist out, give him information, and say, now listen, you can print this, but you've got to say it this way. This is the truth, and P.S., print it as I tell you, and you'll get more. The problem was that leaks turned out to be like Frankenstein's monster. Once created, they could not be controlled. And therefore, a few years after Washington invented the leak, Jefferson, to use one example, was using the very same principle against him.
In telling that fascinating and little-known tale of the two newspapers, both of which were acting as the voices of the warring factions of the administration back at the beginning of the nation, did you get a sense of déjà vu? Your employer, Fox News Channel, has often been tarred with the brush of being the voice of the Bush administration.
It has been charged with that, yes. No one has ever gone so far as to suggest that government money is being funneled to Fox, as government money was being funneled by Jefferson and Hamilton. So I was either wise enough not to get a sense of deja vu or wise enough not to admit it to you on the media. Take your pick.
Eric Burns is the host of Fox News Watch on the Fox News Channel and author of Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Brooke. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We say a sad goodbye to our fabulous interns, Mark Phillips and Ani Katz. Thank you, guys. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.